wake up in the morning, and if things are going slow, I munch a bowl of shroomies, and then I'm set to go. Yes, steaming, heaping, helping, put some life in them, their bones. Gotta have my shroomies, breakfast of champignon. Well, the cereal company called me, said they were in a bind. They needed a new flavor to enhance their product line. I said a mushroom cereal would really stand alone, and we can call them shroomies, the breakfast of champignons. People eat a flapjack or maybe some freedom toast. Some might have a muffin, and you know who likes donuts the most. But there's really only one breakfast to satisfy the Jones, a heaping bowl of shroomies, breakfast of champignons. Yes, a heaping bowl of shroomies, the breakfast of champignons.
All right, the breakfast of champignons, for sure. And we heard Everything's Got a Fungus before that. Great stuff from Larry Evans and his band. Larry, I love the music. You got to talk a little bit about how you guys decided to do this and when you began playing music.
Hey, man, if you have a breakfast of champignons, you're bound to be a fun guy.
I need my drum kit.
Yeah, no, if you don't like puns, maybe it's time to turn the radio down a little bit. Yeah.
Anyway, the music's great, and I know you did a this one is called Fungal Boogeyman, but there was a previous CD that I still want to play at least one off of before we go. But at any rate, you've been making music that has to do with this stuff for at least a few years.
Yeah, I love it. Like everybody, I guess, I probably wrote a few little ditties as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But, I really got interested in songwriting when I met Zoe Wood. And she and Todd Osmussen and I first put together a little song called Name It to Loma.
Mm, yeah, that's on the first CD.
Say what?
That's on the first CD. Oh, no, that's actually, it's on the most recent one.
No, that's on the first one. Name It to Loma's on the, and that was, it was all downhill from there. After that, after I realized you could do that, gosh, this needs to be done.
I see it. Yeah, I was thinking of Hebeloma that's on the new CD.
Hebeloma,
yeah.
Yeah, poison pie in your eye, nothing like a Hebeloma.
Well, it's good stuff, and you got some pretty talented musicians for sure playing with you on this most recent CD.
I've been really lucky. Mike Bader wrote that blues number that you opened with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just
that's a great piece.
Blues composer.
Yeah.
And then I have to say that Andrea Harsell really did a shining job on this Fungal Boogeyman. She arranged a couple of songs there and does the female vocals there on Caterpillar Fungus.
Huh. All right. Does Zoe Wood perform at all on the second disc?
Nope, Zoe's in Mexico. We haven't heard from Zoe for a couple of years now. So, she's pursuing a career down in the Puerto Vallarta, I understand.
All right, well, wish her the best. That's a good set of tunes too. That one that you did with her.
Oh yeah. Fungal Boogie was such fun, and that was there's just so much so much material to draw on. I mean, every mushroom has a song. Gosh, there's a million mushrooms out there, so.
Yeah, so why not write about them? I love it. All right,
yeah.
Speaking of songs that are on the new CD, you've got one that, this one that's called Hebeloma. What is I want to talk about dangerous mushrooms, too, and identification and all this stuff. We've got a number of questions come up with people asking about field guides and identification protocols and this. Is Hebeloma one that we can use as a segue into that particular topic?
Yeah, Hebeloma is a, recently, his nickname is Poison Pie. I guess that tells you what you need to know.
right.
And, there's the thing to remember about two things, one about mushrooms and one about poisons. The thing about poisons is there are about, there's probably a poison for every different mushroom. Some of them just don't work on people.
Hmm.
There's not just one type of mushroom poison out there. We recognize at least six or eight pretty distinct forms of, you know, mushroom toxicity.
Hmm.
And those vary from, like you mentioned earlier, the psilocybin, which is a hallucinogenic type of toxin, or the amanita, the red cap amanita, the fly agaric.
Sure,
As we sing in the first CD, we have a song about the fly agaric, and that has ibotenic acid in it, and that's a very different and powerful neurological toxin.
Right.
And then you have, of course, you have the gyromitrins, which are cellular toxins that actually poison cells on the cellular level, and the amatoxins, which kill people by destroying their liver and kidney function. And then we also have a number of mushrooms that disrupt your body's ability to metabolize alcohol. So it's like as soon as you eat this mushroom, you have a bad hangover, and it may last for days and days.
Huh.
This is not indicated for a good time.
No.
It's definitely a mushroom experience, but not usually something people want another shot at. And then, of course, there are a number of mushrooms, like the Rushulas, that have an acrid component that really hits your trigeminal nerve.
What's that?
That is the nerve that says, ouch, that hurts, I'm being damaged.
Just in a general sense.
It works on your, well, you have these types of nerves in your stomach and on your taste buds, on your tongue.
Mm.
And when you put this in your mouth, it's what happens when you get wasabi or cayenne.
Yeah.
Your eyes kind of flutter and you start to, mucus comes out of everywhere.
Mm.
And, That component, that acrid component, is present in a number of different Rushula mushrooms.
Amazing.
And yet people can soak it out. They soak it in cold water, and then they make pickles out of them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, toxicity and edibility is a many splendid thing.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with mushrooms, you have to realize that there are a lot of different mushrooms and that each one has its own peculiar set of characteristics that are unique to that mushroom.
Yeah, and I think you made it pretty clear earlier that even the same species grown in a different area or whatever could have completely different properties. I know Amanita is something that you have to be very careful with. You got to know where it came from, what part of the growing season, was it at the beginning or the end of the season? Was it grown in this particular environment or another? I know it differs a lot.
Right. We have had poisoning results, actually, of edible mushrooms that seem to have taken up an herbicide, a glycophosphate herbicide, like a Roundup or something.
Great.
And people were poisoned by eating those edible mushrooms.
Because they had sequestered that poison, I guess?
Excuse me?
They had sequestered somehow poison from pesticides?
Yeah, the mushrooms sequester the poison. It doesn't bother the mushroom.
Uh-huh.
But that toxicity can be passed on to people.
Hmm.
So that's another reason that you want to be careful if you're thinking of picking mushrooms by roadsides or places where they might be spraying.
Hmm. Amazing.
Another thing that mushrooms can do is they can bioaccumulate heavy metals. And so they were actually able to find in shaggy manes, for example, that were growing by paved roads, they were able to recover measurable amounts of cadmium.
Hmm.
And the cadmium was coming from the being worn off of tires.
Huh.
You know, the tires on the pavement were wearing off enough cadmium, and the mushrooms were selectively taking it out.
Amazing.
So, I mean, toxicity, like I say, toxicity is a many splendid thing.
Right.
The opposite of poisonous is not edible.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It's
for
not
many reasons something may not be edible.
Right, right.
Sometimes it's the basic toxicity of the species itself, and other times it's something completely different.
Right. All right. Field guides. Is there any that you would suggest, or that are worthy for people to carry around?
Well,
or?
You know, I
sort of hate to ask you that because
I give you a way to figure out on field guides. Okay.
Yeah.
First, you want to notice the date of when the field guide was published.
Okay.
Because names change over periods of time, and I don't think it's ever good to just have one field guide. I would recommend a number of them. But the date is one thing to notice because that will affect the names.
All right.
Another thing to think about is that many field guides that you will see in American bookstores today are actually European guides that have been modified to be marketed in the States.
Mm.
Now, mushroom guides are tremendously popular in Europe. It's a very familiar genre, and they're really, really some excellent guides, don't get me wrong. But again, they're focused on European species.
Right, right, right.
You know, it's a different continent. There's a lot of different species and whatnot. So it's always good to look in the faceplate of the book again and find out where it's printed.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's and find out, you know, the copyright. Is the copyright held in Europe or is it held in the United States? That sort of stuff.
Okay.
So it's kind of an investigative, you know, tool, I would say. If you're looking at a field guide, if you want to get local flavor, look for information about local organizations or local contributors, too.
Yeah, there's a lot of gangs that get together and go out and go mushroom hunting together, and they're very interested in the, you know, the particulars
really
of it.
It's true, and you know, however good a book may be, it's really hard to beat local knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been studying mushrooms for 20 years. I go up and I give a class up in, up in northern Montana, and I mentioned, well, you know, this mushroom's not recommended, and apparently it's not, you know, it has been poisonous. Whoa, hand shot up the back of the room. Three or four people, oh, yeah, we eat that all the time. And, you know, I did try that mushroom, and, you know, frankly, I wasn't very impressed by it. I didn't think it tasted real great.
Right.
But they kind of taste like asparagus, really. But the debate still rages as to whether that mushroom is edible or not.
Right, but it didn't harm you particularly.
Well, it didn't harm them, but, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
I don't know what they were like before they ate it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it can
be might have been really sharp. They might have been really different individuals.
That's the truth of the matter. I mean, you really don't know, you know, how something affects someone if you don't know exactly the way they were before they took it. So.
Yeah, you know, it's
and
hard to
do. And things can be very subtle, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're just... they might be a little different after they eat those mushrooms, right, Ali? But, you know, it's a matter of speculation.
Mm.
I think, you know, mother's milk is a pretty hazardous substance. It's amazing any of us get through that.
Mm. Yeah, you never know what's in it these days, frankly.
Yeah, gosh. Yeah, it's, I mean, you look at the number of, you know, chemicals that they're finding in the human bloodstream today, and you kind of hope that you've got something out there that can kind of balance things out a little bit.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I mean, it's amazing actually that the stuff that they find inside pretty much everybody, I imagine, these days. And
yeah,
you wonder, it's like some, you know, just some wild, uncontrolled chemistry experiment, and nobody really knows where it's going to go.
Well, you know, we are kind of on a chemistry experiment, but the mushrooms, fortunately, just played into my trump card there. The mushrooms do, if a biological process makes it, then a mushroom can probably take it apart.
Mm, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, research over the last over a decade has shown that the number of species of mushrooms that will decompose dreadful toxins is legion. There are many, many species of mushrooms that will eat many, many different types of toxic waste.
Hmm.
It's not like you just turn them loose and they go eat it up, but in controlled, you know, terrarium-type setting, where you've got a mushroom growing on a substrate and you introduce the toxic substances, the mushrooms can take apart things like chlorinated biphenyls.
Wow, PCBs, jeez.
Dioxin, perforants. They can take apart all kinds of glyphosates and all sorts of chlorinated hydrocarbons. So
wow.
There's really, and in fact, Paul Stamets just did a test taking the diesel and penta-contaminated soil and feeding oyster mushrooms this toxic mess. And it completely rehabilitated the soil.
Huh.
Pretty remarkable little experiment. So there's, you know, there's quite a bit of work that's done, and I think there's tremendous potential for some people, you know, enterprising people, to go and start looking at all these abandoned gas stations out there, you know, that are liable because they've got tanks underground.
Right.
And look at using, you know, tons of mushroom spawn to basically eat the gasoline right there in sight.
Huh. Amazing. Now, there's a tremendous amount of potential then in general for cleanup type work. And what about technological breakdown? I mean, metals and some of the things that are coming now from, you know, high-tech wastes, things like, you know, motherboards and some of the exotic metals that are...
Well, metals and mushrooms, you're not going to get too much going on there. There's some biological activity on various metals and
plastics at all?
Plastics, a lot of plastics have the potential to be broken down by fungi, some of it not very quickly.
Mm-hmm. But time is the great equalizer, huh?
Well, yeah, the other thing is using fungi in, there are people just upstream from me here in Missoula, in the beautiful city of Butte, Montana, where they have probably one of the largest pits. And it's filling up rapidly with toxic water, which is caused by sulfur-degrading bacteria that take the sulfur out of the rocks, and they're able to live on that elemental sulfur. And then they produce an acid situation that in turn dissolves the metal salts out. And so this can become a very toxic stuff. But if you introduce sufficient organic matter or wood and fungi on top of that, you can basically put another level of an ecological community on top of that, and you can purify the water.
Hmm.
And so I think there's tremendous potential to create clean drinking water or to remove or strip nutrients from water in order to purify it, and also to take bacteria from water by using fungal cultures again.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really, you know, when you look at ecological processes and the damage that we have done as humans to aspects of the planet, the type of remediation or the type of fixing that we need to have done.
And it can happen in pretty short order. These are things that can be implemented sort of pretty quickly if people put their minds to it.
Well,
at least
yeah,
it seems
you
that
can,
way.
You can grow mushrooms pretty darn fast. There's no doubt about it. One of the things that they screened for, they even found that they could, psilocybin mushrooms would break down sarin and VX nerve gas.
Huh. Another good reason why they don't want people hanging around with those things.
You got to watch out. Yeah, be careful. Pick your friends carefully.
No question about that.
But, yeah, a lot of the types of mushrooms that would grow in feces, of course, they're used to some pretty harsh conditions, you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
If you spend your whole life buried in crap, it's probably going to affect your attitude.
And you might get pretty tough.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of mushroom jokes that lead from this premise here, so I got to be careful.
All right. Let me look here and see if I can get another question before we'll take one more short break here in just a few minutes. Well, this question came up in the chat room. It may or may not be related to a psilocybin mushroom, but a gentleman says, "Hi, Mike. Great show. Would you please ask Larry about the mushroom sclerotia, sclerotia, or often called the philosopher's stone? Thanks."
Sure. Yeah. I think what he's probably talking about is it's a type of a sclerotia is literally a resting body. And it can happen with a number of different types of fungi. On our website, you can see sclerotia that are for morel mushrooms. But the philosopher's stone is actually a type of psilocybe tampinensis, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
It forms a little wad of tissue, a little knot, if you will, or a little potato or something,
mm-hmm.
At the base of a fruiting body or prior to making a fruiting body. And these are fairly durable. Now, sclerotia, again, like I said, they're resting body, and they're usually a mass of fat and fungal cells. These sclerotia that they talk about, the philosopher's stone, do contain some psilocybe, but normally sclerotia are not as powerful or as strong as other aspects of a plant,
mm-hmm.
because they tend to be mostly fiber and fat.
Okay.
They're a resting body there.
So it's sort of an independent thing that grows on the body of a fruiting mushroom.
Well, it's a way that the mushroom deals with drought.
Huh.
When there's no water and it's got plenty of energy but no water, it stores all the energy here, and then when the water comes along, that nugget acts like a seed and it absorbs enough water and then it sprouts.
I'll be darned.
And you'll see this in a lot of different types of mushrooms. And there's a lot of amazing ways that mushrooms have adapted to going without water. There's a type of sclerotia that lives in Niger and Mali, where it actually grows in compost piles that are so dry you'd never even believe that they're going to decompose at all. And yet, if you dig through the compost pile, here's something the size of a grapefruit, and it's a sclerotia of a relative of the oyster mushroom.
Amazing.
And it's a main food source for people.
Wow.
Sclerotia are a pretty widespread phenomenon in the mushroom kingdom.
Okay. All right. I think that is a good chance to take one more short break here, okay?
Cool.
All right, man. We'll be back in just a few minutes, okay?
Okay.
All right, everybody. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, on the line here with Larry Evans from Missoula, Montana. Larry is the director of the Western Montana Mycological Association, and he's also the writer and performer on many of the songs that you're hearing tonight. And you can find all of this information on the website there at fungaljungle.org. And you can link over there from my site as well from here on out. We'll have this program up in the MP3 archives sometime in the next 24 hours or so. And this is a good one we can share with other people. Great show tonight, and very pleased to have Larry on the program. And thanks to my friend Ian for introducing us. I one of the listeners, actually, Larry, was someone who sent me a note and said, "Hey, I ran into this guy, Larry Evans, and he was really cool, and you should get him on the show." So.
Oh yeah, Ian Tobin. He was up at our Mushroom Fest.
Yeah, he's great. Ian's a he's a real cool guy and a real strong supporter of my radio show, and I love him. He's a great guy.
Oh yeah, great individual. He he helped us out with our mushroom our spore imaging project from Bolivia.
Right on.
On the webpage, you'll see that we collect mushrooms in Bolivia and take pictures of their spores.
Yeah, people go on the web and take a look at the. There's all kinds of stuff on here, but certainly lots of information that you can check out, and I'm sure you'll be interested in if you're liking the program. The website over there at Fungal Jungle is really cool. So, all right, Larry, back in just a minute, all right?
Okay.
All right, everybody, it is Mike Hagan, and it is KOPN Columbia, about 1:30 now in the a.m. on the 13th of November, 2007, already halfway through the month of November. Can you believe it? And we will just keep moving right along, okay? We're going to play a piece of music here from the Fungal Boogeyman. This one is called Fairy Ring Marasmius. And it's just a short song, about 2 minutes long, and then we'll come back and have one more segment here with Larry, okay? All right, everybody, it's Mike on the web at Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. Of course, the radio station at KOPN.org. And once again, Fungal Boogeyman.
Green circles in the grass, helmets on, little elven soldiers slowly marching past. Fairy ring marasmias growing on the ground, sometimes in a straight line, but it's always going around. Fairy ring marasmias growing on the ground, sometimes in a straight line, but it's always going around. Fairy ring marasmias, tastier than most. Try them on a chicken sauce or on your buttered toast. Fairy ring marasmias, growing in the pasture now, where its neighbors likely are the horsey and the cow. Fairy ring marasmias, growing on the ground, sometimes in a straight line, but it's always going around. Fairy ring marasmias, growing on the ground, sometimes in a straight line, but it's always going round and round and round. Fairy ring marasmias, you picked your friends with care. Make sure you see some weeds or clover growing there. Fairy ring marasmias, the one they call Scotch bonnet. But are you really, really sure no doggy wee-weed on it? Fairy ring marasmias, growing on the ground, sometimes in a straight line, but it's always going round. Fairy ring marasmias, growing on the ground, sometimes in a straight line, but it's always going round, round, round.
All right, fairy ring marasmius. You know, Larry, I love the concept of the fairy ring, and I've actually seen one once in my life. I think it's one of the coolest things around. Can you talk about the fairy ring and how it actually even happens? What's actually going on there?
Yeah, it's a ring because it's growing out from the middle, like the middle of a donut, and it keeps growing out every year.
Like the ring of an oak tree.
Yeah, and so each year it grows about 3 inches. So if you actually take a ruler and measure across from one side of the fairy ring to another, you can tell how old it is.
But sometimes they come out of nowhere and then they don't show up again for a long time. Is all this stuff conditionally related? I mean, they're just waiting for the right conditions?
Well, yeah. Well, sometimes mushrooms, you know, individuals die. Things happen. Sometimes, you know, mushrooms get poisoned by things. There's definitely fungicides out there. And, you know, because certain mushrooms have the ability to break down amazing toxins, those same mushrooms could just as easily be killed.
Right, by some other
toxin. Dry or too hot.
Right, okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a cool thing that they grow in a perfect circle like that, though, sometimes. It seems like
you know, I think you've probably heard the thing about the world's largest organism being a mushroom. It's the same type of a premise. They found the two opposite sides of the fairy ring, and you know, they realized how big that organism must be if it goes around in a circle between those two points.
Wow, amazing! Do you think that, and this is just an opinion-based question, I guess, but you know, we've been talking about the connection between all of these things all night, and the fact that these webs of, you know, different fungal mycelial networks or whatever are just essentially all over the planet. Would you consider a global sort of connection between these webs? I mean, are mycelial networks in North America, you know, I realize the problem with language here, but in some way, shape, or form, sharing information with, you know, networks on other parts of the globe?
Well, I think it's really interesting, Mike, to see that we have, apparently mushrooms have some sort of common memory across different continents. And, of course, those have been separated for hundreds of millions of years as the continents drifted along. But somehow the certain mushrooms, for example, there are honey mushrooms in Europe and there are honey mushrooms in America, and yet the genetically identical mushroom doesn't look anything near the same in America as it does in Europe. And yet, at the same time, you have two mushrooms that look very much almost identical, and yet, they're completely genetically different.
Yeah, that is weird. There's a lot of these sort of imposter mushrooms that go under the guise of, and who knows which one's the real imposter, but they certainly look alike, but they seem to be very different, right?
Mushrooms we've learned that mushrooms have amazing adaptive strategies, that they have actually the ability to, you know, they've managed to survive every kind of drought, every type of flood, every type of, you know, amazing or deadly situation that you can imagine over the millions of years. And they can shift from, you know, that's what shaggy manes and puffballs are all about. They can take a certain minimal amount of water and then continue their reproductive process even when there's a complete lack of water. And my own feeling is that the spores themselves, any place you open up a petri dish on the planet, you get a bunch of different spores. And I think that the communication, we find the same, in some cases, we find the same mushrooms on different continents. You know, and to me that's just amazing that you've got a gene pool that goes completely around the world.
Right.
You know, it's scary in that, you know, in the implication of that, of how connected things are, and that if that mushroom did get sick or become pathogenic,
how quickly
it
could move.
Already all the way around the world.
Right.
It's not something that would happen. If it happened, it would be simultaneously everywhere.
Remarkable.
So, yeah, there's a certain,
a little bit of a spooky
sound. It's awe-inspiring.
Right. Well, there are people that have argued
pretty convincingly, at least good discussions about it, that the spores of mushrooms could exist in the outer space environments and
certainly capable of withstanding those conditions. And just to know how spores are launched, Mike, it's amazing. Here you've got something, if you look at the microscopic pictures of spores, you can see that they're actually have little spirals on them, like the rifling on a rifle ball.
They sort of jetted out of their chute or something.
Right, so that when it impacts the air, it gives itself a spin.
Uh-huh.
And it's spinning through the air. It's not just, you know, tumbling or bouncing.
Right.
It's spinning in a very, it's corkscrewing its way through the air.
Uh-huh.
And then at the same time, when the fungus launches these spores, it's like a miner setting a charge of dynamite.
Uh-huh.
The spore is sitting there on the basidium, and the fungus pushes out a little bit of, it's like an explosive charge, but what it is, it's a sugar that's explosively attractive to water. It is so hydrophilic, it loves water so much,
mm-hmm.
that in a nanosecond, it can pull every water molecule out from a tremendously large range and pull it into a single water droplet underneath that spore and cause a sudden expansion of the hydraulic pressure there,
right.
Which we can only, the only metaphor we can use is like an explosion.
Right.
And it launches that spore at 500 feet a second.
Are you kidding me?
Almost the speed of sound in some cases.
Holy cow.
Yeah, these are incredible. And whereas you look at a rifle bullet, and you fire a bullet out of a rifle, and it may go, a couple hundred thousand times its length. But when you look at a mushroom spore that's being launched out of a mushroom, this thing is a couple microns long, but it's being launched for billions and billions and billions of times its length.
And it can go anywhere on the planet, essentially.
Once it gets caught in an air vortex, like we talked about, the sky is the limit.
Amazing. Right?
And there's no way, really, to tell whether a spore that's out there in the atmosphere has been there for one day or 1,000 years.
Right. They're essentially immortal until they find the right conditions.
Well, and here we have another amazing reality that fungi have that we can only imagine, and that is the fungi have, like plants, they have the opportunity to mate with their grandparents. They can mate with their grandparents or with their grandparents' peers.
Mm.
Or their great-great-grandparents' peers.
Right, ad infinitum almost. Amazing.
And, and that transgenerational type of breeding is not something that we even want to think about. It's scary, huh?
Yeah. That's one of the no-go zones, typically. You know?
Yeah. Oh, we can't talk about that on our radio?
Right. Hell, we talk about anything on this radio show. All right. The history of mushrooms and the relationship between human beings and mushrooms goes way back. Do you think that there are just some people that talk about a revival of some sort, some of the ideas that were being, maybe used back when that Iceman that you were talking about was running around. And mushrooms obviously played a significant role in that particular guy's culture. Do you think that it's something that was a global thing and that it is still alive or maybe being revivified?
Oh, yeah. I think if you're familiar with the story of the sacred psilocybe in Mexico, you're aware that the Native Americans basically hid the secret of psilocybin for 400 years.
Yeah, at least 400 years.
Before they brought it back up.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a different way of knowing, Mike, away from the empirical type of knowledge that we always pursue. And that is more of the what the some of my associates call talking to the plants.
Mm-hmm.
That they communicate that rather than to learn a set of properties and attach it to a particular plant or leaf, there's a way to intuit the information from the living organism,
mm-hmm.
or to see its strengths and or weaknesses by communicating with it as a living thing.
Yeah, directly. I mean, it sort of makes sense if you think about it on just sort of the general human terms. I mean, it's a lot easier to get some information out of you, you know, since you're living and breathing and talking. I'd have a much more difficult time trying to get the information that I got tonight if I were to go and, you know, if you were no longer living and I had to chop you up into the smallest pieces and then try to analyze them, you know what I mean?
That would take a lot longer, too. And it's even easier than, it's even harder to go to the website.
Yeah.
And that's a lot easier.
Right, right, right.
Than writing me a letter, waiting for me to write back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very, very amazing what's happening, actually. All right, let's see. We got a few more minutes here. Growing mushrooms. Lots of people are interested. I've tried my own hand at it, and I think it's fascinating and interesting. I'm always blown away by the difference that a wall makes. In other words, you know, outside, these things can have their way. You've been talking about some examples tonight about how amazingly resilient they are and how they can survive in different conditions and all this. Yet inside, the whole story changes, and it becomes something that's sterility is a major concern, and it's not something that's really easy to do if you're inside. But outside, you just sort of throw them on a compost heap, and when the conditions are right, there you'll be.
It's kind of interesting. There's a couple of different approaches to the whole thing, of course. But you have to realize that when you're moving inside, or when you're trying to make a desirable home for your pet fungus, you have to realize that everybody likes a feather bed.
Mm.
You know, if you make a big, if you spread a big banquet, you'll get some guests. And that's the thing, is that people are usually very concerned about spreading. They're so concerned about spreading a good banquet for their pet fungus that they forget that there's a lot of other rogues out there as well.
Yeah, they're looking for the feather bed too.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's hungry. Everybody likes to eat.
But outside, it seems that it's somehow more evenly matched. Inside, it seems like the other guests can take over very quickly, unless you really, really keep things under control. What's the difference between the inside and outside?
And I think that the other thing about outside is that you've got, you have a very, again, complex medium.
Mm.
When you're growing inside, you're getting all of one thing, and it's very, it's all very pure and very specific. And the reason you do that is because you're planning to get some really rapid growth. You want the mushroom to eat the whole banquet.
Right, right, right.
And outside, it's more like, you get a snack here, you get a snack there. It takes you a year to get to the point where you're ready to throw spores.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, actually. Yeah.
And so, there's something to be said for a natural cycle of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, we are pretty clever monkeys, by golly, and we do know how to speed the process up, but whenever you speed the process up, you got to remember that you're speeding the process up for everybody.
Right. Will an outdoor mushroom bed, for example, will it be able to? First of all, like you say, it takes some time to develop it. If you have a little bed, it might take a couple of years. But will it survive the winter? Can the mycelium survive the winter? Or
definitely. If you dig yourself a little trench there, 16, 18 inches down, and and you line it with some, you know, fresh wood chips that you put down, and then you put in your inoculum, another layer of wood chips, make a little sandwich there. By the time your chip pile is 3 or 4 inches above the trench, you'll have a culture that will last for years, and it should start producing within a year or so.
Amazing.
You can get a number of, and I think, you know, outdoor growing is really a good way to do things as well, because, you know, it's just growing out in the garden there. It's just, you know, it's just a mushroom growing in a ditch.
Yeah, and it's a thrill to see the stuff grow outside, actually, too, because it's in its natural environment. I've grown mushrooms indoors and had, you know, it's, you know, once you get it down, you can do it. It's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, the growing medium that I'm sure some people are familiar with is this little half pint jar, right? That you fill it with a substrate or whatever, and then inoculate it, and then, you know, and then these little half pint little cakes, I guess, can then fruit mushrooms if you get them in the right.
They're like, you're thinking like a rice or flour,
right,
or
right.
something, and vermiculite.
Yeah.
That.
Well, I've taken one of those things, and then you know, after it had fruited a few times inside, then, you know, take them outside and throw those in the compost heap and throw some hay on top or whatever and a little bit of water. And, man, I've seen mushrooms come out of there that are the size of, you know, small dinner plate almost.
Yeah, they'll do much better.
Yeah,
much
it's
better.
Remarkable.
Well, you know, straws, they're home. They love that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if it's been through a cow, well, it's still straw, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially.
To a mushroom. A mushroom, again, a mushroom's not examining the golden color and the texture of the straw. It's just trying to taste that cellulose.
And,
yeah, before or after it comes out of the cow, it's all about the same as a mushroom.
Amazing. All right, we got a few minutes. Tell us another story before you say goodnight.
My favorite story is the story of how we found out that truffles are eaten by squirrels.
First of all, for people who don't know what a truffle mushroom is.
Truffles are the underground mushrooms that that fetch hundreds of dollars a pound. You can see several pages about it on the website. And they are definitely an aphrodisiac. They contain substances that are like mammal sex pheromones. And that's how they attract everything from pigs to squirrels to come and eat them up.
And then help spread their stuff around.
Yeah, and, well, you can imagine, if you've had a couple, if you had an ounce or so of truffles yourself, you know that it gives you a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling. And you can imagine if you're, you know, that's a 100-and-something-pound man, and you can imagine if you're a 2-ounce squirrel. It goes like that. You are super squirreled, man. And those lady squirrels had better watch out for you, by the way.
I love it.
Romeo, here I come, baby.
Oh,
but,
boy.
Yeah, so there's definitely some, it's an amazing thing that the truffle has managed to seduce squirrels to carry the spores around.
And quite a few humans, too, I have a feeling.
Oh yes. It certainly caused a bit of a sensation. But how we found out about this was that we found flying squirrel bones in lynx scat.
In what?
In the scat of a lynx.
Uh-huh.
Of a wildcat, of a bobcat.
Yeah.
They found flying squirrel bones.
Huh.
And they said, well, now, how can this be? A flying squirrel spends his whole life up in the trees. He's never on the ground. But sure enough, he had to be on the ground because there was no way that this lynx was going to climb up to the treetops to get him. And so, boy, did they look for the answer? Well, they looked for the answer in the scat of the squirrel.
Hmm.
And sure enough, there in the scat of the squirrel was the truffle spores. And when they took a look at that, they realized that these little guys are risking their lives to come down there.
Hmm.
And eat these mushrooms. And their feces are like the germination points for the truffles that then make a mycorrhizae with the tree root and provide the nutrients that keeps the whole forest going.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Unbelievable, but absolutely, totally cool. I just love it.
It's just great stuff. I love studying this stuff.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for sharing the little bit that you could here in the last couple hours. I'd love to do it again sometime, Larry.
Oh, yeah. It's great, Mike. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, we'll take some phone calls, too, next time. We talked about it earlier. We didn't really even get a chance. The time tends to boogie on by. But anyway, it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much. And I'll be in touch, and we'll get this program up on the web here real soon, and I'll shoot you the link for that, too. And if you want to put it up on your website, you can share.
Hey, that'd be great, buddy. We'll definitely zip a link in there for sure.
All right. Sounds good. Take care of yourself, and thanks again, Larry, okay?
All right. Thanks, Mike.
All right, everybody. It's Larry Evans. He's the director of the Western Montana Mycological Association on the web at www.fungaljungle.org. Fungaljungle.org. Like I said, you can get a copy of this program on the web here real soon once we get the MP3 up there in the next day or so. All right, big thanks to Larry. Wonderful stuff, and I hope you all enjoyed the program. We'll come on back next week and do it again next Monday with... Actually, I'm going to do a special for Terrence McKenna next week because Terrence was born on the 16th of November, 1946, and so we're close enough to his birthday that we'll do something special for T next Monday, and we'll sort of, I guess we'll continue the mushroom theme in a certain sense, and bring some good music from John Cale along with next week, okay? Thanks all of you for joining with us tonight, and I hope you enjoyed the program. We'll do it again next week, 11 p.m. on Monday on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. In the meanwhile, here's one more from Larry Evans. This is from the first CD that's called Fungal Boogie, and it's a song called Silly Sided Mushrooms. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, and we're probably going to sign off now. Ruth is working tonight. I'll play some music for the next few minutes here and then take the station off the air until about 5:30 in the morning, all right? All right, everybody, take care of yourselves, and thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you next week. It's Mike, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
Holy moly, yaddy yaddy, everybody's ready to party. When you've got those silly side mushrooms, everything is looking funny. Walls are melting down like honey when you're on those silly side mushrooms. First thing up, you start a giggling. Pretty soon, the walls are wiggling, playing with those silly side mushrooms. They will surely make you mellow, stem of blue and cap of yellow. And if you are feeling down, stipe of blue and cap of brown. If you're feeling sad and bitter, need extra neurotransmitter, silly side mushrooms. Cap of yellow, and if you're feeling down, stack the blue and cap of brown. For the kinds, pupil dilators, plant you now and dig you later. Mother Nature's mood elevator makes pharmaceutical companies frown. Grows in manure for pennies a pound. Psilocybe's the best antidepressant around. Stem of blue and cap of brown. Find serotonin in vodka, growing in the caca de vaca. It's that little silly-sided mushroom. Yellow, and if you are feeling down, stipe of blue, cap of brown. Once their identity you have mastered, you can find them in any cow pasture, talking about the silly-sided mushrooms.